Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley, Speak for Yourself. Brought to you by Hyundai. All right, let's move out to BJ Armstrong's crib. BJ, of course, played in the first three-peat with the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan. Yeah. BJ, I'm sure you watched Last Dance last night. You just heard my opening monologue. I blame Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf for ruining the greatest dynasty perhaps in sports history, undermining Michael Jordan's passion. Does the Bulls front office, does their management deserve all the blame for the end of this dynasty?
Well, you know, the one thing I can say about Michael Jordan is nothing was going to deny him to achieving what he wanted to achieve. And that includes the Bulls front office, the league, or whomever. You know, the man just had an undeniable spirit about himself. It's easy to depict based on what we saw last night. But if anything, I will say this. Michael Jordan was going to do what was ever necessary. And certainly I can say without question, he was going to achieve and stop playing whenever he wanted to stop playing. And he did exactly what he wanted to do because he deserved that. And I think that he made that clear last night. And he was very evident about his passion and what he was going to bring to the game.
Exactly. I don't think there's any stopping Michael Jordan. He would have found a different setting, different situation, coupled with another great player, and they would have had optimal results. It's just, you just saw a determination that jumped off the screen that was second to none with that ability. That was just special.
Are y'all both sitting here telling me that if Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf had treated Michael Jordan with the level of respect that his play deserved, that Michael Jordan wouldn't have continued to play after winning that sixth championship? BJ, you go first.
Yes. Well, there was something, you know, in knowing Michael Jordan, and I worked with Jerry Krause. So I knew both. I worked in the front office for the Bulls, and I knew Michael Jordan. There was something that you have to know a little bit about Michael. Michael said, was the glass half full or was the glass half empty? And it was Michael's father, you know, rest in peace, who said the following: if you want to get the best out of my son, just tell him what he can't do. So I know that Michael was not going to be denied. I don't care what was said, because no one was going to come on the floor and beat Michael Jordan. No one. And he was going to do what was ever necessary. And he was devoted to his sport. He was devoted to winning. He was devoted to the game. So whatever was going on, he was comfortable being uncomfortable in all of the drama, all of the things, all of the characters, because in the end, he was the lead character. He was the lead character. He knew it. We can say whatever we want to say. If you want to blame them, certainly. But you know what? No one beat Michael Jordan. No one. And until someone beat him on the court, then you know what? We can, you know, you can say a lot of different things, but the man was unstoppable. He was unstoppable. And I'll continue to say that you know what? We can talk all we want to talk about those guys, but you know, Michael Jordan did what he had to do.
And I have a slightly different way of looking at it. And I want you to put some respect on Jerry Krause's name when you start talking about it, Whitlock, because here's the thing about him. He's a necessary part of this. If you want to call it a necessary evil, so be it. But this chemistry, talking about player and executive, was so necessary for Michael Jordan. As you just mentioned, BJ, that his father knew his dynamic mentally, that, hey, you tell him he can't do something, he's going to be even more motivated to do it. That's one. So now you have a power structure of a good cop and bad cop out of Krause and Reinsdorf. And what happens? You get this dynamic where we're going to look at and polarize Krause for being the guy that we don't respect. But guess what? He played a necessary part in agitating Michael Jordan, not always giving in to Michael Jordan, not always kissing his feet at the altar of greatness. He had to be the one that had the thorn that was going to poke at Michael Jordan here and there. It seems like, because Reinsdorf gets off clean. Hey, Scotty, don't sign this contract. Hey, I try to tell everybody what to do right. Come on, you sign off on everything. So Krause was just an intermediary to get to the final destination, which was this relationship, good cop, bad cop, between those two execs. I'm almost wondering if we watch two different broadcasts of Last Dance, because I'm not sure where y'all live in L.A. I don't know where. I got Spectrum. And so on Spectrum, saw Michael Jordan on Spectrum Cable last night say, if there's no Phil Jackson, I don't want to play for anybody else. He made that crystal clear. These guys were so cheap, they didn't want to pay Phil Jackson. So petty, they didn't want to pay Phil Jackson. After he won 5 championships, he got a 1-year deal for $6 million. And they announced before the season began, this is his final season. And the greatest thing we've seen in the NBA and the greatest thing we've seen in sports since Babe Ruth says he don't want to play for nobody else but Phil Jackson. But somehow, I can't blame Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf for this kind of lunacy. If you can't convince me that if they had reached some kind of long-term deal with Phil Jackson, and if they hadn't reached some kind of deal to keep Scottie Pippen, the guy said this is his favorite coach, and Scottie Pippen is his favorite teammate. This is a perfect match. They left Michael no choice but to retire at 34. Did y'all see this?
Well, you can say that, but this is what you have to really look. Let's go back to Scottie Pippen. Scottie Pippen also had what wasn't said, and I don't want to be a spoiler here for the documentary moving forward, but Scottie Pippen had major back surgery early in his career. And I'm not talking like a little. Anytime you have surgery, it's a major thing, but he had major back surgery. And I think that weighed heavily on his decision-making process. I don't know. I've never spoken to Scottie about it. But that had to weigh heavy, because when you have major back surgery as a young player, that could potentially, you know, end your career. You know, the one thing that we saw with Michael Jordan, when Michael got injured there early in his career, it gives you a sense of urgency to really focus from the future to now. And, you know, yes, Michael wanted to only play for Phil Jackson, but what he was really saying was the following. You know what? I'm playing in a system that I feel comfortable with, and I don't have time to start new relationships. I don't have time to find out what this guy can and can't do. I'm in the meat and potatoes of my career. I'm not in the middle of my career. I'm really at the end of my career. He's 34, 35. And he had to play with people right then, right there. And I think it was important for him to say, if we're not going to do this and make a commitment with this group, then I would much rather move forward and not play at all, because he didn't have time to be developing new relationship at that point in his career.
This conversation is just highlighting the cost of greatness. And the key word is not greatness, it's cost. The NBA was finally getting the money, and the money was coming in. And if you start to do your projections, if you're an executive, you start to realize what it's going to cost to continue this greatness. You have Michael Jordan, who's only on a 1-year deal at $33 million. You have Phil Jackson making $6 million on a 1-year deal. You have Pippen's deal coming up where he was lowballed, so now he's going to get his money. Remember the context of only 9 players were making 8 figures. Now you're going to suggest to the Bills, to the Bulls, to have 3 of those players and to add a coach to that. I think they made a calculation because of Scottie Pippen's injury concerns, because of the lack of commitment that they've gotten from Michael Jordan, including the retirement before. They were like, wait a minute, half of the top dollars in the NBA is all going to be on one team? I want a lot of things in life, but what usually keeps me from attaining them is the cost. And I think that's what they just went to, a simple mental calculation. We got 6 out of 8. And that's a great thing, but to do more and to roll the dice may be too costly.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that decision. That could be the end.
It's a dumb decision. And BJ, I like your point about the back injury and Scottie Pippen, which is another reason they should have had some sympathy and reworked that deal for Scottie Pippen. After 4 or 5 years, get a man his money, what he earned. All right, we got to keep it moving. Thank you, BJ.
That's my dog.
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley on a Tuesday afternoon. All right, time to pull up in Houston.
pull up to a excellent quarterback and even better leader, Jalen Hurts, the former Alabama Crimson Tide quarterback, the superstar with the Oklahoma Sooners last year. Jalen, I want to start with a somewhat of a crazy question. Do you think your leadership qualities actually overshadow or stop people from appreciating your actual talents as a quarterback? I'm so enamored with your leadership qualities that I don't think I fully appreciate just your physical talents as a quarterback.
Well, you know, everybody sees it from a different lens. And for me, I always try to be a positive influence around the guys I'm around, set the right example, do the right things, and just go out there and perform at a high level. Very fortunate to have played for the two schools I've played for and have had the success I've had with both of those schools. So, like unprecedented times right now, my whole entire college career was unprecedented. So being able to lead at two dominant programs and win championships at both, it was special.
All right, after you save Alabama season, I tweeted out, I hope one day this guy runs for president because of just the way you've handled that situation. If you were not an NFL quarterback, what would you do with your life?
I don't know. I never put a limit on myself. I'm not saying I run for president, but definitely being in a position where I can impact people. I know I have two men in my family that are coaches at the high school level, so I could use my degree, put it in use. A lot of different things I could do, but regardless, I'd be wanting to help and being a positive influence and impacting people.
Now, let's circle back to you being a leader. That situation with you at Tua, Alabama, you handled it so selflessly. It seems like you got undervalued as a competitor. 38-4 record on the field. Talk about how ruthless a competitor you really are.
Yeah, I'm a dog, a warrior. I'm a relentless competitor. You know, I try and go out there and be the best I can be every day. And I've been around great people that have been able to push me to do those things. And I tell you, this football stuff, man, this is what I love to do. The desire, the constant thirst for knowledge every day, to get better every day, and take those steps. It's always been a goal, is just to be the best, and to have this opportunity in front of me, it's a blessing.
Yeah, and there's comparisons to some great quarterbacks, Russell Wilson, Deshaun Watson, and others. Who do you compare yourself and your game to?
You know, I can see those, and as well as a guy I have a lot of respect for, probably more so your time, Steve McNair. That guy there, man, the physical abilities he had, the ability to throw the ball like he did, and how he used his skill set. He was a very dominant player, and for me, I take notes on everything. I'm a sponge. I soak it all in, and if it can make me better, I'm always jotting it down, and I'm always taking notes. So there's a lot of great quarterbacks, and I'm always all eyes and ears.
Yeah, a lot of great quarterbacks. Not as many great developers of quarterbacks, but you played for one in Lincoln Riley. What makes Coach so special in terms of developing quarterbacks?
Yeah, Coach Riley, man, it's crazy how it all went down, you know, because I got there in such a short time, and you know, he kind of does what he does within his system. And biggest thing for me was just going in there and learning it, spending a lot of time with CeeDee Lamb and all the other guys and getting it down. And from there, it was kind of go out there and perform and go win ball games. I've had a lot of great coaches over my college career, going from Mike Locksley to, you know, Dan Enos, Coach Kiffin, Coach Sark, and Dable. All of them have played a pivotal role and who I am as a quarterback, so I'm appreciative of them all.
Yeah, and you also play for the GOAT of all college coaches, Nick Saban. The greatest difference between Coach Saban and Coach Riley?
Man, one's, I always say, one's about, what, 65, 70 plus, or I don't know how old Coach Saban is, I forgot. and one's, you know, in his mid-30s. But, you know, Coach Saban, he's a very impressive guy, man, like Coach Riley. Great coaches.
Now, how much was the talent gap between the SEC and the Big 12? And don't lie to me, dog.
Man, you know, people have an assumption about Big 12 defenses. I had a lot of respect for them. They're very physical. They rally to the ball. They run different schemes defensively. But it was challenging, and I accepted and I embraced it, preparing for those different things. And it was cool to be able to say that. Not many people, obviously, can say they played in two conferences and won conference championships in both.
Jalen, are you trying to break some news with that Cowboys banner behind you and the name Hurts? What am I looking at that properly? Are you campaigning to go to Dallas?
Look, I didn't even think about that before I said right here. This is a deal. So look, when I was in high school, they had these awards. Texas High School Football Player of the Week. And me and my brother, you see, that's my brother's name right there. If I move my head, mine's over there. But yeah. See, look, But nonetheless, it was an award that me and my brother won in high school, and they actually had the ceremony in Dallas at the stadium. So we were able to go down there when we were in high school, and that was cool. Great experience. So this is, it's just on the wall from when we were kids in high school.
Let me ask you about your draft prep, going through the combine, the interview process. Did any teams, and you don't have to name them if they did any teams try to suggest to you about changing positions?
No, sir. I've won a lot of ball games playing this position. The whole time, my face is getting out of the camera. Yeah, see what that's about. Technical difficulties. Did we get it?
That's going to be all over the internet. You trying to replace Dak Prescott, man. That's going to be all over the internet.
See, y'all having fun with that. I'm not even entertaining that right there. But
okay, so no one asked you about switching positions. That's what I was at. No one asked you about switching positions. Do you think the success that Lamar Jackson had this season changed the way people will evaluate quarterbacks, particularly athletic quarterbacks who can run a little bit? Has he permanently changed the way they're viewed as NFL prospects?
Yes, sir. I think it introduces a unique dynamic at the position, and just for me to have this opportunity going into this next level, going into the next step, and see how things are changing offensively. I think there's a great fit. You know, I talked about guys like Russell Wilson, Deshaun Watson, and Steve, and so forth. So we'll see what happens. I'll be ready to go to work, and I'll be as hungry as ever for sure.
All right, I'm going to circle back to my dream presidential team for 2044, I believe. Jalen Hurts, Tua Tagovailoa. Who would be vice president and who would be the president in that scenario?
Does a president get to vote for themselves?
Absolutely.
I don't know how that works, but that'll be for the people to decide.
That was a presidential answer right there. That was.
He will be president one day. All right, let's get out of here with a question up from Gillette. How has the Gillette helped you prepare for the NFL draft?
Yeah, they're doing a lot of great things, given the circumstances, virtual, red carpet, give me an opportunity to showcase some swag and showcase my outfit for the big day. So hopefully I got y'all's approval on that.
Yes, you sir. You certainly have our approval, and thank you so much for the time. Good luck with whatever team drafts you. You're going to be an amazing leader, an amazing quarterback. You're going to have a lot of success. Thank you so much, Jalen.
That's my dog.
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. Time to pull up down in Ponte Vedra, Florida, right outside of Jacksonville. And let's talk to Tony Boselli, former NFL great, a member of the 1990 All-Decade team. Awesome left tackle. All right, Tony, but you're now known for you came down with and you survived the coronavirus. Now, look, you lost a bunch of weight. You're a triathlete. You're one of the greatest NFL players of all time. How did you come down with corona?
Well, first of all, let's hold the brakes on the triathlete. That was a long time ago. Right when I got done football, I'm back to being fat again. And so I'm all over the place. I need to go on your diet. I need to get something going there. But, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, the whole thing starts with, you hear about this coronavirus. I wasn't worried about it much. And I started feeling sick and found out that I was at an event where someone had it. And next thing I knew, I get tested and I come back positive. My wife was positive. My two boys end up getting it. And even after I got it, I didn't think much of it because I'm healthy. I'm 47 years old. It's not a big deal. And a couple days later, I end up in the ICU at Mayo Clinic. So it was a crazy process.
What did this experience teach you about yourself?
Well, I tell you, it makes you appreciate every day and the people around you, the people, family and friends, because, the uncertainty of what was going on was eye-opening to me because I go to the hospital after my doctor told me to go, and I in the emergency room, and they take x-rays of my lungs, and they say, hey, you need to go to the ICU. And next thing I know, I got all these smart doctors telling me they don't know what's going to happen to me. And they're putting me on oxygen, putting me on all these drugs. I'm thinking, what do you mean? What do you mean you don't know what's going to happen to me? Like, I could die from this? And you realize, because people are dying from this virus. So it makes you, have some serious conversations with God, and it also makes you say, all right, there's no guarantees in this life. Let's enjoy what you got and the family, the friends, and make the most of it.
Now, Tony, let's stay with this experience. Like, physically, what did you feel? How was your body feeling when you were experiencing this?
Marcel, you remember when you play up Mile High and you can't breathe and you can't catch your breath in Denver during a game? I mean, that's
yeah.
And so
yeah.
I mean, and so it's like all of a sudden one day I wake up, my lungs are full of fluid, and I'm not saying I can't breathe, but I'm wheezing and it's a struggle. I'm laboring is the best way to say it. And when I got to that point is you're hearing the reports, you get scary. Plus your whole body just feels like you have the flu, I guess. I mean, you're sore, you're tired, you're fatigued. And so it was as bad as I've ever felt. And once you go through it, feeling healthy again, I'll tell you, that's one of the things I won't take for granted because, that process, made me really realize that health is something that is a blessing and it's a gift. And when you have it, it's pretty good.
Now, you ended up at the Mayo Clinic, as you said, and I'm certain that your mind had to go to some dark places. Did you ever think you might not recover?
Yeah, I mean, your mind goes really dark places. When they came in and said they had to up the oxygen levels I was on and it wasn't enough, and the pulmonologist came in and said, hey, we're not sure what this virus is going to do. We're going to do our best. And we'll have to wait and see. At that moment, the thought of is, am I going to die in the ICU by myself because your family's not there? And you have to fight those thoughts. And I fought them. That's, I think, where my faith came in. And, you have those conversations. You start praying. And you try to stay positive because it's a battle at that point. And if you give in to the negative thoughts, it's not going to be good for anybody.
Now, I need you to put your doctor's hat on because your wife and your two sons also contracted corona, but your three daughters didn't. So what theories have you come up with why they didn't contract it?
either they got it and they're asymptomatic, like a lot of people are, or they have the greatest immune systems in the history of mankind, because they were, you know, my two boys came home from college. They were on spring break, which creates a chaotic situation in my house, because my three girls are princesses, are quiet. They're so good. My boys are nuts. And so here we all are in this house, all sick, and my girls are doing all the work. I mean, they're serving us, making us food, you know, cleaning up. And somehow they never got it, or they never got sick. So we're actually, as soon as the antibody tests come out and are more widespread, we're going to get them tested. And maybe they got it and they were just asymptomatic. But I'm glad that they didn't have to go through it.
Now, what precautions are you taking, and any concern that you can catch it a second time?
Yeah, no, I'm not concerned about it. I mean, I actually just did some blood work today again at the Mayo Clinic to find out about the antibodies. I have, you know, very high antibodies count. And so they say for right now, I'm immune. How long that immunity will last, you don't know. But for right now, my antibody level is high enough where I'm going to start giving, donating blood and the plasma so they can spin out the antibodies for really sick people. And so I'm waiting to hear when I'll start giving blood so that hopefully it can help some people. So right now I think I'm okay. And so, you know, I'm still trying to be smart, you know, because half the people, you know, you go out and I'm trying to ride my bike a little bit, get some exercise, build my lung capacity back up. And people look at it and they think, oh, there's the Corona guy. There's Buscelli. And so, you try to respect it. What I want to say is, listen, I'm the safest human being to be around right now. Because I already got it and do have the antibodies, but you know, so we're trying to be smart about it, and we'll see what comes, where it goes.
Tony, let's move to your career. It was an incredible 7-year run in the NFL, but probably a little shorter to make you a first ballot Hall of Famer. You've been a finalist 4 times. Go ahead and be a little arrogant. Make your case. Why should Tony Buscelli be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be careful because, you know, it's one of those things that self-promoting. I mean, it's not, I mean, Jason, you're an all offensive lineman. That's not really what we do. I mean, that's the defensive guys. It's the wide receivers where we self-promote. I mean, but I think the greatest thing I could say for, you know, my career, or what's meant most to me, is the guys I played against who are in the Hall of Fame say I'm a Hall of Famer. I mean, I played in an era where some of the best tackles who ever played the game. One that you know, Jason, from really got behind when Willie Roaf was coming up for the Hall of Fame as a great player. We played at the same time. And during that great era, I was first team all pro several times. And so I think those are the things, you know, my peers, what they say about me, the guys who played the position, that means more than anything. Obviously, I want to be in the Hall of Fame one day. Hopefully it happens and it works out. But it's really, that's up to the voters, and we'll wait and see what happens.
Tony, I want to tell you a story. It's one of my favorite stories in the world. It's something you probably don't know about, but I want to get your reaction to this story. So everyone always asks me who was the best tackle I ever played against, and I say Walter Jones. But yep. What they don't ask me is who's the best tackle I've ever seen or evaluated or scouted, and it was you, Tony Buscelli. So let me give you a little backstory on this. In 1996, you played against the Buffalo Bills in the playoffs, yep. And you went against the Bruce Smith. And Bruce didn't have a sack in that game, and you guys won that playoff game. You come back in 1997. I'm a rookie. I'm not getting a lot of reps, especially in pass situations. I'm just there for the run. And I remember that was an important game to Bruce, and he was looking forward to going against you again in 97. You shut him down again. 2 times, Bruce Smith didn't get a sack on Tony Buscelli. Fast forward to the next year. We're playing you in 1998. And now I'm getting reps. I'm going against. Yeah. And I was sitting there watching you, scouting you. And in the middle of scouting you, Bruce says, Marcellus, sit your ass down this week. You are not going against him. He's all mine because he wanted to finally get one on you. Buscelli, let me tell you the truth. When he said that to me, everyone thought I should have felt embarrassed. I was so relieved because I was like, I do not want to go against that damn animal on the field. Now, that third time, he finally got a sack on you. But when you hear the great Bruce Smith, had to go through that much of a mental anxiety going against you. How does it make you feel?
No, he's a great player. I mean, he's one of the best ever, and I always love playing against him. And I've never been more scared going into a game as a second-year player in 1996. He was defensive MVP, and no one had blocked him all year. So, and I had a good game. It was fun. I like playing him. I like getting nasty with him. I like getting physical. And I'd like to go back and look at that third game or something. It might have been a coverage sack. I mean, I'm not sure, you know. We got to go, you know, sometimes Mark Brunell like to hold the ball a little bit too long. And by the way, it's not like you had any day at the beach. You had to go on the other side against Leon Searcy, who was, you know, it wasn't easy to go against my man Big Searcy either.
But Sally, tell him, I thought I was actually doing better, and I was like, this is hell over here as well. Searcy was so strong, right?
Plus, his punch will take your heart. He'll steal you. He'll break your chest plate with that punch of his.
Yes.
Tony, really appreciate the time. We've run out of time, sadly. Marcellus probably doesn't know this, but coming out of college, a lot of people call Tony Boselli the next Jason Whitlock, Marcellus. put a lot of
expectations. No one knows that.
I watched your tape at Ball State, and you were a big influence of what not to do at left tackle. And so all the things I saw you do, I said, I think I could be a great player if I don't do that. And then talking to Joel Schmang, who played against you at Ball State, he said, listen, I played against this guy named Jason Whitlock. I'm telling you, you're going to be a great player because you're nothing like him. So I appreciate all you did, Jason.
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself. Today's big story is sponsored by KFC. Feed the whole family with KFC's $20 fill-up with all the fixings. Order online at KFC.com.
That's my dog!
All right, welcome back to Speak for Yourself. From the crib, Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. All right, time to go out to Dallas. And let's go out to a golfer, a six-time winner on the PGA Tour, a friend of mine over Twitter, Hunter Mahan. Thank you for joining us from your crib in Dallas. Interesting idea being floated about. Tiger Woods and Peyton Manning and Phil Mickelson and Tom Brady competing in a charity golf tournament to benefit, you know, coronavirus relief. I like this idea. I don't love it. And the reason I don't love it is because I think they need to add Wayne Gretzky and Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, and Michael Jordan. And then you have a must-see event, a can't-miss. Then I would love this idea. Hunter, what are your thoughts on this unique idea of Brady and Manning facing off in golf with Tiger and Phil?
Well, I love your idea, actually, more. I think it's actually a phenomenal idea. to see live golf, though, to see a live sporting event, to see guys of those guys' caliber talking back and forth. Hopefully we can get some insight on what made them great. It's going to be an amazing event if they can pull it off. It's obviously going to have a huge charity aspect. I think there's going to be plenty of people watching. I know I will be. So hopefully it benefits a ton of people. And hopefully we get to see a little bit of insight into what makes those guys so great.
Yeah, I love the idea, as is, and I even love Jason's idea, where you lean more into the fun than just the competition. We all can go back to when Tiger and Phil had their first match. And golf is a tough sport to really sell everyone on the competition element just because of the mechanics. You never go against each other as much as you go after each other. So if it's a little looser, I think it's a better product to digest. And in a star sports world as we're in right now, it beats a game of horse and NBA 2K. So I'm looking forward to seeing this matchup.
Let me tell you where I think y'all are both wrong. If y'all think Tom Brady, Tiger Woods, Peyton Manning aren't going to compete and be into the competition, you can throw Phil in there as well. And then if you throw the other guys, if you throw Michael Jordan in there, Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, the competition, I think, would actually be the star of this, not the fun. And yeah, do I want to hear these guys mic'd up and talking back and forth to each other, talking a little trash?
But I think these guys, as much passion as there is from golf from any of these guys, and just the way Brady and Manning just compete all the time, I actually think the competition is going to drive this. I would be very interested in who wins and who performs well in this.
Well, I think it's sort of expectations. I think the last time we saw Tiger and Phil have their match, I think our expectations were that it was going to be super competitive, but it kind of fell flat because it was sort of just, you know, a made-for-TV event. But this could be with, I totally understand what you're saying, Jason. This would be super competitive if you had about four groups of guys going against each other, kind of going back and forth with the competitive nature of all of them. Like you said, with maybe another guy with a Jordan or with Gretzky. I do agree with you. The competition will be raised up another level. But I do like the aspect that we're going to take competitions a little bit, push it aside, and let these guys have some fun and sort of enjoy themselves. Because it is only two groups. I think you would raise the level of competition with four. But with just two and four guys out there playing, I think it is going to be a lot of fun. It is going to be competitive. Nobody in that group likes to lose. But I think the competition would be raised with another two groups in there playing against one another.
Man, it's not going to be competitive. It's going to be competitive with a wink. Like, okay, we're trying to give everyone some entertainment and a little distance from their social distancing. But this is not going to be competitive. It's kind of like how when you watch baseball, it's a completely different thing what you feel when you're playing baseball versus if you're sitting back watching it. And I think that's what's going to happen and what's going to get lost here. So lean into the entertainment value of this. The first episode, they try to lean into the competitive element, and it fell flat. So let's not make the same mistake. I don't care what personalities, what level of competition you have in terms of namesake. When you get out there and this is just a made-for-TV event, pro-am style, it's hard to turn it up all the way to the full notch.
No, you're not going to see a full notch of Tiger and Phil, that's for sure. Like I said, that's why I think Whitlock's idea of having two more groups in there, I think would raise a little bit level of competition amongst each other. But I think this is a smarter way to go if you're going to do some sort of made-for-TV charity aspect, is having players from other sports come in and enjoy it. And I think for the fans, you're going to bring more fans from different sports and different aspects. Like, we haven't seen Peyton Manning in a long time. I'd love to see him for a few hours, talk about what he's doing, what he's maybe interested in doing. Tom Brady, we haven't really heard from since he's joined the Buccaneers. So I'm really looking forward to these guys talking and talking about maybe their new endeavors in different cities and different sports and different, and different entertainment kind of value.
Now, Hunter, I got to ask you this question. We have a mutual friend in Tony Romo, my former teammate. Obviously, he's an avid golfer, and if you know Romo, he's always talking about how good he is. Does his game make it on the PGA Tour? Could he be out there with you guys?
No. In a short answer, no. He is someone who loves the game more than almost anyone that I know. And like you said, he's not an avid golfer. He's a golf junkie. He absolutely loves it. He loves every second of it. I think he loves tinkering with the game. It keeps his competitive juices flowing. He's, as you know, Marcellus, he is competitive as anyone I've ever met. And he loves to go out on the golf course and play and compete with all the other guys. And he loves to measure himself against all the pros that he gets to play with.
Now, who,
all right, Hunter, how
if
about
it's not
this?
Romo,
had,
who's
had
the,
he committed?
Who, yeah. I just want to know who's the best golfer you've ever seen as an athlete.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Hunter.
If he could have played earlier, Jason, I don't know. You can tell football is his first love. I mean, that he is passionate about football. He's poured his heart and soul into the game. If he did it at a younger age, maybe he could have. He's extremely talented. I mean, he's an extremely talented athlete. I mean, he's a heck of a basketball player, a golfer, a football player. I mean, there's not many things he can't do. But you never really know. I mean, golf is a sport about, it's not doing it for one day and beating a pro. It's about doing it for 2, 3, 4 days and week after week. And that's the real challenge of being a professional golfer.
Hunter, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we'll see
Appreciate
you guys
you,
back in action sooner rather than later. All right, stick around.